you're listening to On the Point, the News Collective show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Joshua Azizi.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Maddie Delplane.
And I'm Grace Jenkins. It's Friday, November 13th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on the UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today we'll be chatting about the City of Vancouver's Climate Emergency Action Plan, which will be voted on next week in City Council. We've got an interview with Alex Boston, the Executive Director of SFU's Renewable Cities Program. He's here to chat with us about the City's climate plan and what he thinks its strengths and weaknesses are.
We'll then talk about exploding COVID-19 cases in the Lower Mainland and new restrictions put in place by the Health Ministry.
There will also be some discussion about another potential Vancouver Olympics bid and the final results from the British Columbia election after mail-in votes were counted. But first, let's think further ahead about the City of Vancouver's climate plans. So, Josh, can you tell me about the city's new Climate Emergency Action Plan?
Sure, Maddie. In December 2018, Vancouver City Council declared a climate emergency. 3 months later, in April 2019, city staff presented to council, quote-unquote, six big moves that could decrease Vancouver's carbon emissions by 50% from 2007 to 2030. These moves are, one, ensuring that 90% of Vancouverites live within a short walking distance of their daily needs. Two, making sure that two-thirds of all trips in the city of Vancouver are done by walking, biking, or transit, as opposed to driving. Three, having 50% of the kilometers driven on Vancouver streets done by electric vehicles. 4. Cutting carbon pollution from buildings in half, in regards to 2007 levels. 5. Reducing emissions in new buildings by 60% from 2018 levels. And 6. Restoring enough carbon-capturing ecosystems to remove 1 million trees of carbon every year by 2060.
So how does the city plan to achieve these goals?
Well, on November 17th, City Council is voting to approve a series of recommendations to achieve just that. The most notable recommendation is the implementation of mobility pricing in Metro Vancouver's downtown core. This means that if you drive into Vancouver's downtown, you'll be charged. Parking also plays a big role in the proposed plan. For example, there are Vancouver laws that mandate a minimum number of parking spots that get added to new buildings, and the recommendations want to flip that around and make it so that new buildings need to have a maximum limit of parking spaces. Other ways the city is trying to reduce emissions from cars include expanding the city's biking network, promoting working from home options, and improving bus speeds, and expanding the availability of charging ports for electric cars.
And how about reducing emissions from buildings? Because I know those create even more carbon emissions than cars do.
That's right. Over 50% of Vancouver's carbon emissions come from natural gas used to heat homes and buildings. To bring down pollution from buildings, some of the recommendations include making it easier to retrofit existing buildings, creating incentives to encourage the use of building materials that require less carbon heating, and requiring emissions reporting from some homes and buildings.
So what has the reception to this plan been?
Well, just like everything else these days, reaction has mostly fallen upon partisan lines. Environmentalist groups are mostly in support of it, but some business-oriented groups have expressed some concerns. It's mostly the mobility pricing part that's gotten the most heat. The Greater Vancouver Board of Trade sent a letter to council last week, expressing concerns that charging drivers could harm businesses in the city and simply shift both traffic and consumers into the suburbs. But on the other hand, climate policy experts point to it as a key way to reduce emissions. And cities such as like London and Singapore have put in congestion charges, and they've seen a decline in car usage and increasing transit activity.
Well, seems like a lot of people have, let's say, strong opinions about this. On that topic, Josh, could you tell us about the guest you have for today's episode?
Yeah, so I wanted to reach out to an expert to hear their opinion on this plan, and so I got in touch with Alex Boston. He's the executive director of SFU's Renewable Cities Program. He sent a letter to council encouraging them to support the plan, but he noted some recommendations and concerns he had as well. He admired much of what was written about in the plan, but he noted that mobility pricing could increase congestion outside of downtown Vancouver. But yeah, he knows the stuff really well, much better than I do. So yeah, let's play the interview. So I guess kind of to start out, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and what you do?
So my name is Alex Boston. I am executive director of Renewable Cities, which is situated at Simon Fraser University's Center for Dialogue. And I have worked with local governments, senior governments, real estate developers, utilities for 20 years on communities and climate change.
So I guess we'll start out with the basic question. So what were your thoughts on the Climate Emergency Action Plan that the city released?
The most important thing is I loved its boldness and how seriously it's treating climate change. And that's what every level of government has to do. The other part of it that I really liked is the deep integration of land use and the deep integration of equity. Those two elements, the equity and land use, have been acknowledged in a serious way. And those are areas where there's significant room for improvement.
Can you tell me a bit more?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, the city of Vancouver has some really bold targets around how it's going to shift transportation into active travel and transit modes. And it has some really bold targets around rental housing unit generation on an annual basis and some targets around GHG reductions on the short term. Those can't be done without really significant efforts to move a lot more residential and commercial activity around underutilized transit stations and transit hubs in within the city. And that fundamentally needs to be a big part of the city plan update. And it isn't as robustly acknowledged. We have transit stations in the city of Vancouver would cost today $50 million a crack. And they have the same single family land use regime around them today as they did when they were built 30 years ago. That's a waste of money. One of the concerns on this plan is how do we afford everything that's in there? Well, one of the ways that we can do it is much more cost effectively taking advantage of these big infrastructure investments that we're making.
So just to kind of to simplify it, so like kind of the concern is, you know, there's all these homes throughout Vancouver, but for people to live within like a close walk of their needs, they need to be near something like a transit hub?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's more than that, but that is a big part of it. Like if we think about it, within Greater Vancouver, about 20% of the population is within a kilometer of rapid transit. Interestingly, it's about 20% of our mode share is in transit. You go to a place like Barcelona, and 60% of the population is within a kilometer of public transit. Of rapid transit. Joshua, you know what their transit mode share is?
I've heard that term a lot, but it's admittedly a term that I see, but that I can never remember the definition of.
Okay, so the transit mode share is the share of people that take transit as part of their trips.
Yeah.
In Greater Vancouver, 20% of people use transit for their trips. Mm-hmm. And we interestingly have about 20% of the population within a kilometer of our rapid transit lines. In Barcelona, you have 60% of the population within a kilometer of rapid transit, and 60% of trips in the region are taken by transit as a whole, not just rapid transit, but transit as a whole. And our problem is we have spread the peanut butter so thinly across the entire region and in the city of Vancouver that it's very difficult to cost effectively get people onto good transit systems. You know, revenue comes from ridership, and you don't get ridership without focusing growth in those areas. And that's how we can cost effectively move people around the city of Vancouver and the region.
And another thing that I wanted to ask about, probably the one part of the climate plan that got arguably the most attention, was the topic of mobility pricing. And it was something that you listed some issues with in your letter. Can you tell me a bit about kind of what your opinions on it are?
So some type of mobility pricing is something that we can hugely benefit from in terms of better utilization of our transportation infrastructure. The problem with the city of Vancouver's proposal, and it's doing this because it's acting alone and wants to take a leadership position, which is commendable, is that it has proposed a cordon-based approach where there's a congestion charge attached to going into the metro core. One of the problems with that is that over the last 20 years, what we see is a growing amount of reverse commuting in Greater Vancouver. So people coming out of the downtown core into peripheral areas. We see a growing share of jobs in highly distributed areas. And that wouldn't be a problem if it was Surrey City Centre or downtown Richmond or Metrotown, but a huge amount of them are going in far-flung greenfield developments, and you can't cost-effectively move people there on transit. So one of the implications of having a congestion charge and coming down into the downtown core is that we chase employment further out to these areas where it's cheap, and we continue to subsidize urban sprawl. And while it would reduce congestion and carbon in the city of Vancouver, you actually increase it in the rest of the region. Because what's happening is every year, people are driving further and there's more and more cars on the road. In British Columbia and in Greater Vancouver, our vehicle stock is growing at twice the rate of our population. What the city is proposing as a possible approach to managing carbon could potentially have the reverse impact, and it could increase carbon and increase congestion around the region.
So if it was implemented, it might, you know, decrease congestion around the downtown core, but because so many people commute to and from somewhere like the Fraser Valley or maybe even the Sea to Sky Highway, then it could just shift the congestion there?
Yeah, that is where the congestion would be shifted, but that wouldn't be a function of people in the downtown area going to Abbotsford or Squamish to work. But what would happen is that you could have employment generation in peripheral areas of the region that can't be effectively served by transit. Mm-hmm. We really, across the region, have to focus residential growth along our corridors and around our hubs, notably the system of rapid transit infrastructure that we've spent so much money on. You've got to take advantage of it.
And in regards to that issue, what do you think would be like a better approach to mobility pricing?
So the development of mobility pricing needs to have a couple of really important tenets. And the city has acknowledged those, some of those important ones, notably equity. Let's develop a system that doesn't inadvertently and disproportionately increase costs on low-income households. Several other really important ones: manage congestion, manage carbon on a regional basis. A third one is begin to reflect the real costs of infrastructure use. If you're using the roads a lot, you should pay for them. The best approach for polycentric regions, i.e. regions that have a whole bunch of different employment areas, which we've increasingly had over the last 20 years, is actually a distance-based regime. So the more you drive, the more you pay. It's not something that can ever be developed successfully without doing a bunch of other things. It's part of a system. You have to build up your transit capacity. You have to build up your active travel infrastructure. And when you've done that, then you can phase in mobility pricing. On top of that, and something that we need to do, is have a lot of conversations across the region with different players to optimize that system and cultivate literacy. You know, it's interesting, across this region, we have used pricing regimes to effectively manage demand. And what ends up happening is that we all pay less. And in West Vancouver, for example, The municipality boldly introduced water pricing. They metered water. What happened? Well, there was a massive reduction in water use. Did the lawns dry up, and did all of the beautiful landscaping in West Vancouver suddenly start to be compromised? Not at all. We had the same quality experience walking through West Vancouver communities that you always had, but people were just more prudent. And that's happened in the city of Surrey. City of Surrey has introduced water metering. And so they have this rapid growth in their population. They are not growing the amount of water that they're consuming. The same thing would happen with a well-designed mobility pricing regime.
And another thing I wanted to ask about was the proposed plan's approach to parking, with making things like residential parking permits citywide. What were your kind of thoughts on the plan's approach to that?
Well, this is I think this is an important discussion, and I think it also has to be treated really carefully. In the residential areas, there's opportunities to move boldly, and there aren't going to be massive negative consequences. So higher on-street parking prices and restrictions in residential areas totally make a lot of sense, and that should be everywhere. Our roads aren't free. We actually have to pay for them, and we pay a lot for them. Let's start incurring those costs. So yes, we can price parking much more effectively in residential areas, and we're all going to benefit from it. Number two, we have to consider the consequences, though, or the implications of different parking pricing and restriction regimes in our commercial areas. There's areas where we can increase prices and restrict the number of parking stalls, and it's not going to hurt us at all. But one of the things, Joshua, that we don't want to do is the same thing that could happen with the congestion charge, is drive employment out to peripheral areas. In areas where you have employment or commercial areas, things have to be treated a little bit more uniquely. So location and neighborhood type really fundamentally matters.
Something that always strikes me when I'm reading about things like carbon emissions in Vancouver, and I remember I did a little bit of reporting when the climate emergency was first announced in Vancouver. I remember reading was that natural gas heating in buildings, that actually takes up just a huge portion of the city's carbon emissions, and that kind of surprised me. And in your letter, it seemed like you had a lot of praise for the city's approach to kind of reducing those emissions. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
So this is, climate change is one of those issues that we're not going to solve with a silver bullet. You need a whole bunch of silver buckshot. And part of that buckshot is increasing energy performance. And this is where the city of Vancouver is just batting it out of the ballpark. It has arguably one of the best, and it's not perfect, but one of the best new construction building policies around. It's influenced the city, the entire province, and it's actually, its approach is starting to influence other provincial governments and how they're approaching building policy as well. And but by 2032, we'll have net zero buildings that we're building right across British Columbia. And the city of Vancouver is blazing the trail on that. So it's easy in new construction to phase out natural gas. Our challenge is that the existing building stock, and particularly older buildings, single family homes and your semi-detached and your ground-oriented housing and your smaller buildings, we can electrify those with all sorts of different approaches. The challenge is in our bigger buildings, we need to not only switch out the heating system with electric systems, we actually, to cost-effectively do it and to even provide enough electricity to power the building, we have to work on the demand side and increase efficiency. That's going to be super difficult to do in some of our older building stock. So fortunately, the solution there is essentially biomethane. We're doing some great work in this region. The city of Surrey takes compost that's put at the curbside by residents, by businesses, and they're putting it in an anaerobic digester. They're generating biomethane that's injected into the gas grid. And basically, you can heat your home, you can run cement plants, you can run heavy-duty trucks on organic waste. And that's something that we have to do. We have to think in a much more systemic manner. Take dairy waste, take organic municipal waste, take wood waste, and we have to use that and optimize its use in a manner that a big share of it is going into generating biomethane. And that's one of the ways that we're going to decarbonize our buildings.
And so I know that you've been like doing a whole bunch of media spots about this whole climate plan, and you were interviewed in the Vancouver Sun about it. And then kind of something that you said in there was that this plan needs further support from like senior government levels, such as the province. And well, notably, you compared the province's commitment to climate action with casual Tinder dating. Can you expand on this?
Really, this is fundamentally problematic, is we have a provincial government that has made these bold commitments to take action on climate change on the near term and the long term, and the policies and plans just do not fundamentally match their commitments. So I do, I look at their commitment to the climate akin to Tinder dating, because really there isn't any long-term commitment there. If you take a look at jurisdictions that are really having an impact, you look at a place like California, where, oddly enough, ironically, they take commitments seriously. They're the only jurisdiction in North America that is driving transportation emissions down. And in this province, the NDP government, following on the Liberal government, are expanding construction of roads, expanding laneway space, and they're facilitating urban sprawl. The fastest growth in transport in emissions in British Columbia is in the transportation sector of the provincial government's approach to transportation planning, and it's messing up our communities. So what we need is we need a provincial government that starts to develop policies that really match its commitments. And one of the important spaces is accelerating zero emission vehicle agenda, but it's also helping reduce the massive growth in our vehicle stock. We need a retrofit agenda in this province as well, so that we can deal with these super carbon intensive buildings and reduce the amount of money that people spend on energy on a monthly basis because they're so leaky.
And so this is something you just kind of went into a little bit, but like what kind of other policies would you like to see from the province?
So the big policies that I would like to see is a real integration of the transportation and land use agenda to reduce the surging growth in vehicle stock that we're experiencing in British Columbia. The Liberal government, the NDP government, time and time again have made commitments to cut congestion and cut carbon, but they're not doing it because expanding highways just puts more vehicles on the road. In the absence of requirements for local governments to focus their growth, and it doesn't have to be towers. We believe that density comes, in two formats: single family and then tower. We need a whole bunch of missing middle activity, which people find very, very attractive. And particularly with our aging demographic, people love being able to walk to the butcher, the baker, the cappuccino maker. You can't do that in most of British Columbia, and you can't do that in most of Greater Vancouver. We need the provincial government to support livable communities, and those are communities that people can get around with a diversity of transportation options. It's not about eliminating the car, but give people good, attractive choices for alternatives over and above the car. So that integrated transportation land use agenda is really important. The building retrofit agenda is super, super important. Accelerating progress on zero emission vehicles is really important. They're in the marketplace now. We don't have to wait for the United States to move. The desire amongst British Columbians to buy zero emission vehicles is super high.
So I know that one of the main concerns that a lot of people have with these proposals is affordability. Like there was the spokesperson from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation commenting on the cost of things like mobility pricing. And, mobility pricing, parking permits, things like that cost money and can put a financial burden on people. How do you think concerns like those should be addressed?
Well, there's a couple of really important considerations, and some of them, right off the bat, is we have to really appreciate the diversity of costs associated with this agenda. And it's not only the cost of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it's also the cost of climate change. The impact of climate change on our lives in terms of costs, makes COVID pale by comparison. To give you a sense of already just some of the costs that we've incurred, we have more than 20 years of exports of softwood lumber to the United States that disappeared to the pine bark beetle. They just disappeared out of our forests. There's a clear climate fingerprint in insect infestations. When we take a look at the last several years of forest fires, we have years in which more carbon goes into the air from forest fires than we burn in all of our vehicular activity, all the natural gas systems in our home, all the industrial activity that exists in this province. The amount of forest that we've lost is huge. If we have over a meter of sea level rise or a meter and a half of sea level rise, the billions of costs in public and private infrastructure is just something that we can't handle. The annual costs in terms of respiratory health are just immense. The loss of agricultural productivity, these are the type of things that are gonna seriously compromise our economy, compromise our lifestyle, compromise our health on a long-term basis. So when we talk about costs, we have to look at multiple sides of the ledger, because the cost of climate change is huge. And if you think COVID costs you something, take another look. And the people who are going to experience it the most, unfortunately, are young people. When it comes to taking action, we have to be smart, and we have to really think about where we're spending our public dollars and where we're spending our private dollars. We spend too much money on transportation in our lives because we have an inefficient land use regime. We can strengthen the efficiency of our land use, and we can spend way less money on transportation. That's something that the city is trying to address. 40% of households in the city of Vancouver are occupied by only one person. One person, and that's growing. The fastest growing household in British Columbia and Canada is the one person household. That's in single family homes, it's in multifamily homes. There's a huge numbers of opportunities for innovations, notably in our single family neighborhoods, which comprise still in the city of Vancouver, 90% of its urban land. What can we do? Well, secondary suites, which the city of Vancouver has already actively advanced, laneway housing, but we can do more than that. We need to think about 3, 4, 5 units per single family parcel. And it's not obliging people to do it, but it's creating, making it very attractive if a homeowner is so interested. It's also putting in place programs so that people who don't have the capital or feel uncomfortable becoming a landlord can easily transition into that role. When I say that, we spend several hundred thousand dollars on a new social housing unit. What would happen if we spent $100,000 on a plan to support a nonprofit to manage secondary suites on behalf of seniors, because they're disproportionately represented in single family homes? We could probably generate on $100,000 a year, we could probably create 100 to 200 affordable housing units. Those are the type of strategies that we need. We have to start thinking outside the box, and we're not even thinking it inside the box at what's happening inside our households. Our homes are about people. And fortunately, so much climate action thinking is about the envelope, and it ignores what's happening inside the envelope, and that's the people who live there. We need to start bringing the people back into the climate agenda. And, you know, the city is starting to make real progress in that regard by acknowledging the importance of equity and affordability. But right now, what those are acknowledgements. They aren't deeply embedded and integrated into the agenda.
Kind of a similar question to what I had earlier. Like, Vancouver is just one city in Metro Vancouver, and I don't necessarily think the other cities throughout the region are taking as ambitious an approach as Vancouver is. Does that kind of like make all the efforts of the city feel somewhat futile if, like, you know, Vancouver is working so hard to decrease its emissions, but maybe somewhere like Langley isn't? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's Joshua, it's a very good question. And it would be easy to have the impression that City of Vancouver is going it alone, but that's not actually what's happening. There's incredible leadership by cities across the entire region. You know, the best zero emission vehicle policy work being done in Greater Vancouver was actually led by the City of Richmond, where they required new commercial and multifamily buildings to install charging infrastructure. And the leadership work by the City of Richmond was adopted by the City of Vancouver. And it's actually been being adopted by cities across North America now. You know, the City of North Vancouver has done amazing work to drive improved building energy performance and new construction. They've played a really critical role. You have demonstration, you have the City of Surrey, as I mentioned earlier, which has the first anaerobic digester that's converting organic waste into biomethane to decarbonize everything that we run on natural gas. So there's leadership happening all over Greater Vancouver. Some of the best leadership that you will find in North America is happening here. We have to scale up all these efforts, and that's part of the market transformation process of a city moving first. And the City of Vancouver has to be commended. What it's been doing in new building construction policy, in pushing literally the envelope in new building construction, that is changing construction sites and legislative corridors across British Columbia and across Canada. And it's because of a really innovative approach. And interestingly, other local governments that have been doing innovative work have added to that, and it's helped the provincial government create this world-class step code that so many jurisdictions around the world are looking at. We have to start doing that in the existing building agenda for retrofitting our buildings.
So this plan that the city's put forward, or the city staff put forward, has some pretty ambitious goals attached to it, like, you know, declining emissions levels from 50% from 2007 levels by 2030. In a few words, can the city realistically achieve this, or all the goals that they kind of listed out?
The goals the city have are technically tenable. They can be achieved. The challenge is some of the policy and planning work needs to be strengthened in order to meet them. There's much more integration that has to happen, and the city is starting down that road, effectively considering equity and affordability. That has to go much further, but we also need much more regional collaboration, and we need way more provincial collaboration. This agenda fundamentally cannot be delivered, and these targets cannot be met unless the provincial government steps up to the plate. And hopefully the city's ambitious work will help, will inspire the provincial government to really start moving in that direction.
And that's all I got. We've covered a lot of ground. Is there kind of anything else you wanted to go over or emphasize before I head out?
No, I think that's it, Josh.
Awesome. Thank you so much for this.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder, and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. to volunteer with the food bank, or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
Welcome back to On the Point, your source of alternative and undercover news from the Lower Mainland. You just heard Alex Boston, Executive Director of Renewable Cities at Simon Fraser University, talking about the City of Vancouver's Climate Action Plan. Let's talk about another potential Vancouver City Council plan that caught people talking last week, and that was when Councillor Melissa DeGenova spoke about a potential Winter Olympics bid for 2030.
Indeed she did. That motion was actually tabled way back in April because of, well, everything. It got pushed back until last week. And it will actually be pushed further into next year because the council voted to delay any talk about it until early 2021.
We'll definitely talk about that when the city council vote goes down. But I wanted to put this into context considering how, let's say, controversial the last Winter Olympics were here in Vancouver. Homelessness doubled in the city in the 7 years after the Olympic bid was won in 2003. The Olympics took place just after the recession hit, so that fueled a real estate boom in Vancouver that we're still suffering through. DeGenova did speak about the Games generating $1 billion in GDP, but that just means that they just about broke even. And before the 2010 Olympics, there was actually a plebiscite among Vancouverites that was won by the yes bid, coming in around 64% to 36%, so about 86,000 votes against 48,000 votes or so. So my question to all of you is, how would you vote if there was a similar plebiscite held today?
I'm going to be unequivocal about this, a firm no. I don't think, I think the idea of prioritizing people like tourists and people coming in from outside, even in a decade's time, is a good idea. I think the problems being faced by, you know, Vancouverites and people who live in the Lower Mainland today are not going to be helped if we spend a lot of money trying to host a games that will be held in a whole decade, like that's 10 whole years time. So, you know, especially coming off the pandemic, I just don't see this being a good idea.
I agree. It seems that the negatives outweigh the potential benefits.
Yeah, and I mentioned this on a mysterious recording that sadly went away, but Olympics are Olympics are very much both a nationalistic and a project that don't really take into account the people where it's being hosted. I mentioned the Rio de Janeiro World Cup held in 2014 and then the Olympics held in 2016 in the same city. The amount of damage that did to the natural environment and everything, that was incalculable. It was very, very expensive for the planet. And I mean, ultimately, it might have increased a lot in terms of Brazil's national standing or whatever, but I don't know if Canada needs that right now. I don't think Vancouver needs that right now.
I also think that the city is going to have a pretty hard time, I think, selling it as far as like how poorly the homeless populations were handled during the 2010 Olympics. I don't see anything super convincing that indicates that basically the same thing's not just going to happen again. There's so many different steps that I think need to come before that in order to just guarantee that we're going to have a handle on like decriminalization and adequate supportable housing. And I just don't think that the city is going to be able to roll out all the things necessary to not before 2030 to be able to reassure us that we're not just going to kind of throw a bunch of people into hotel rooms again and then not have any sort of follow through. So I don't know. I hate to do the argument of like, why are we thinking about this when we still have this on the table? But I will say exactly that. Like, why are we thinking about this when there's still so many other issues on the table? So.
And that's something that I think, as for like this motion in council that's going to be voted on what seems like an eternity from now. I think that's what most people and most of the politicians are going to say too. Like, yeah, there's just so many issues happening at the moment. And I think most of our elected officials get that, and they're going to see this and think, yeah, no, this isn't something we necessarily need. And I don't think it's something that too much people necessarily want. Like, yeah, the Olympics were fun, but I don't think we're all going again for it.
Also, it would just be super boring to have, like, the same place for the Olympics 2 decades apart. Like, come on. Like, I would not. That's just so boring. I'm sorry. I'm just from, like, a purely consumer perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so strange, too, to try to conceive of, like, a future right now that would involve having so many people from so many different places in confined spaces and, like, traffic and accommodations. Like, we're living through essentially the opposite of that at this present moment. So I don't know. It just seems, I want to be optimistic, but it seems sort of unwise to plan for that at this point.
Speaking of,
like, maybe we should be using our mental energy to deal with our current problems instead of planning for a future event.
Yeah. And, you know, especially with, like, people were predicting a pandemic long before this. So, like, no one really heard them. So, like, I don't think putting any chickens in any sort of boxes is going to work out for us. On the topic of ill-advised things, let's talk about the British Columbian election that just ended. Well, obviously that ended almost a month ago now. But mail-in votes finally got counted last week. And I'm going to, as you may know, we take an interest in the riding of Vancouver Lingara, where the, you know, there was, it was pretty close between the NDP candidate, Tezka Trong, and incumbent Michael Lee. Well, Michael Lee just managed to pull it off. It remains in the hands of the BC Liberals for now. Only 3 seats actually changed hands from the final mail-in count. So the mail-in votes were counted now. So 2 ridings, one in Monashie and Abbotsford Mission, they went to the NDP, and those are both huge pickups in the sort of Fraser Valley area. And West Vancouver seat Sky, Josh's home riding, was reclaimed by the BC Liberals by a margin of just 41 votes. So the small margin means it's required by law to undergo a judicial recount. So there's still a chance, however small, that the riding sort of flips back to the BC Greens, but let's see. So if you were keeping track, that means the final seat count is 57 for the BC NDP, 28 for the BC Liberals, which is the lowest, and 2 seats for the Greens, which means they still maintain official party status. And I think this is the second highest seat count for a elected government ever in British Columbia, which is pretty, just shows you the extent of the BC NDP's win, really. So yeah, that's pretty much the update on that. I don't really think there's too much to be said in terms of that. So let's go for a quick break, and then we will be back talking about COVID. So let's do that now.
We got a theory. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We know how magnets work.
That's right. If magic is all we've ever known, then it's easy to miss what really goes on. But I've seen miracles in every way, and I see miracles every day.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Welcome back to On the Point on CITR 101.9 FM. Let's end the show by talking about COVID-19 here in British Columbia. More than 1,000 cases were announced over the past 2 days, with a record 594 cases on Wednesday. There are currently more than 3,000 active cases in the province and 20,369 total cases.
More than 2/3 of the new cases were in the Fraser Health region once again, which includes Surrey, Burnaby, Delta, and Langley. Adrian Dix, the health minister, spoke about Fraser Health specifically earlier this week.
The case counts today remind us that while there's a focus of cases in Fraser Health, that there are cases all over British Columbia today. and there will continue to be, and that different health authorities have different challenges. In Vancouver Coastal Health, there's actually a higher degree of hospitalization today than even in Fraser Health, in spite of having significantly fewer cases than we've seen cases in Northern Health, and communities flare up in communities since the beginning of the pandemic. Tells us that COVID-19 is with us everywhere, and we have to deal with it everywhere.
So we've seen a lot of the cases coming from private events like weddings and funerals. That's what the province is trying to stop in the Lower Mainland with the new rules Dr. Bonnie Henry and Health Minister Adrian Dix announced on Saturday. While these restrictions aren't as sweeping as those introduced back in March, they are the broadest we've seen in BC since the start of the gradual reopening in May. They apply to residents of Vancouver Coastal Health and Fraser Health regions, and will be in effect until Monday, November 23rd. People are being told not to socialize with anyone outside of their immediate household. This includes outdoor gatherings and gatherings in restaurants. However, going on a walk or bike ride is okay as long as you're careful to physically distance. People who live alone are allowed to maintain a bubble of one or two people. Dr. Bonnie Henry strongly recommends that travel in and out of Fraser and Vancouver Health and Vancouver Coastal Health regions be limited. Indoor physical activities such as spin classes, yoga, group fitness, dance classes, etc. have been suspended, as well as indoor sports where physical distancing can't be maintained, like boxing, martial arts, hockey, volleyball, basketball, and basketball. These rules don't apply to school-based sports, gyms that don't operate group fitness and where physical distancing can be maintained, and pools. Restaurants are able to remain open, but are being asked to review their COVID-19 safety plans. Workspaces should be encouraging everyone who can work from home to do so. Party buses and limousines have been ordered to stop operating immediately, possibly beyond the 2 weeks. Dr. Bonnie Henry said that keeping schools open is a priority, and they are not currently a source of major transmission here. If these restrictions aren't enough to slow the spread of the virus, more drastic measures may have to be taken. Mayor Kennedy Stewart said Wednesday that a full Vancouver lockdown would be at the discretion of public health officers. A few weeks ago, we talked about the anti-mask protests in Vancouver. Those folks are protesting against a lockdown when there wasn't so much as a mask mandate. What do you think their reaction will be to those new restrictions, or if Vancouver does go into a full lockdown?
So, in terms of the reaction, it's sort of a weird thing for me, right? Because for, let's say for a month and a half, or around 2 months, let's say, it seemed like we had the COVID cases under control, right? And then really over the past 3 weeks or so, it's just exploded almost exponentially. I can't really pinpoint a point at which people stopped caring, because I don't think that's really how it worked. But I think what really the reaction that maybe allowed people to like do this was the private events, and like something that Grace mentioned was like weddings and funeral stuff. So like as gatherings were allowed, this sort of laissez-faire approach, cases started exploding. So it wasn't really a, oh, we don't want to follow the province anymore, we don't want to like do that stuff. It was more like such a gradual process that of people slowly stopping caring that that's what happened. So in terms of the reaction to this, I hope people don't get like too upset, because like if you look at the case numbers, it's pretty ugly. Like I don't see how you would want to go to the bar after this, even if you were completely socially starved. I just don't see that as wise. But I don't know, maybe I'm not a normal person, because apparently I'm not at a party bus. So, yeah.
I just can't believe party buses were, like, still able to run.
I'm very curious who was still going on party buses in the middle of a pandemic. I'm trying to think optimistically, but maybe these restrictions will be, like, a wake-up call to some people, like how Akshay was talking about, who has sort of gotten to like that, oh, it's okay, I'll go to a restaurant, I'll go to a bar, I'll be careful, but I'll go. And not thinking that that's such a big deal. And maybe one person doing that wouldn't be, but if everybody does that, then everybody is out and about. So maybe this will be enough of a wake-up call to enough of those people that it will make a difference.
I'm also hoping that the imposed like new restrictions will be sort of like a firmer line, like it's more consistent and clear messaging, which is sort of like really at the impetus of like solid public health policy and like how the media talks about that. It's because honestly, for the last couple of months, like the messaging has gotten murkier because people have, they are going through pandemic fatigue. Like it's, it is arguably difficult to be in crisis for like 8+ months straight, you know? So I think that like when things sort of eased up in the summer, people had a hard time letting go of that. And so, you know, I'm hoping that most people will either take this as like, okay, like this is very clearly what we're being told to do now. I guess we have to do that. Or they'll be peer pressured into that. Or, you know, I guess on the other hand, the people who are left are either, I hate to say it, just somewhat irresponsible, or they're like blending the not wearing a mask thing with like a civil liberties issue. And that's where I think it gets really dangerous. So I just kind of hope that it's mostly a messaging problem and like a COVID fatigue thing that can hopefully be iterated out of most people's minds. So,
see. Yeah. And on the topic of like the messaging getting murky, there was actually a few days of confusion where people, like initially the order was like, hey, you can't meet people outside your safe sex. And now they updated to say, hey, it's just your household. And then there was some confusion about whether you could go outside and meet people. Again, I don't know why you would, but in this weather especially, but you know, like going outside to meet people, some people didn't know if you could do that. And like some people, like there's this really like funny thing where like the province is like, hey, you can go for a walk for someone, but just want to ensure it doesn't become like a group meeting. And that just sounds such a like a slapstick comedy routine to me. Like you're just walking along and then people join you. Super funny. But yeah,
Very popular though, so that would be an issue for me. Like all the time I'm going walking with friends and then suddenly like 12 people come join me.
Yeah, it's so funny to me. So the messaging over the last week, I mean, it's become concrete over the past few days, but when the restrictions were first announced last weekend, it was all up in the air. So that is sort of unlike the messaging we've seen from the health ministry over the past 6 months or so. So that was a little disconcerting. And also, I think the fact that these restrictions came in after our like third record day shouldn't have been the case, you know? Like, I think they should have put in these restrictions way earlier.
I mean, I don't have any hot takes. I just think, truthfully, I hope that the restrictions will do something. And like Maddie mentioned, like there needs to be more clarity in the restrictions because otherwise it's a lip service and no one's going to follow it. And even if you like double down on restrictions, there are still going to be people who think they're above it and don't follow the rules and think they're so edgy. And that's fun and great and all. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith in people.
And why would you? Something I wanted to highlight that Grace is currently quarantining because she just got over the border to Vancouver, and now she's gonna. Tell us about what you're looking forward to as your quarantine expires next week and there's nothing open.
I will enjoy being able to go outside.
What have you been doing inside all this time?
I have been inside as much as physically possible because you're not supposed for the mandatory 2-week quarantine after arriving in Canada. You're not supposed to leave where you're quarantining unless like you're having a medical emergency. Luckily, I haven't had one of those, but that also means that I haven't been outside in a while. So that'll be nice. I'll be out on Sunday, so I'm going to go on a long walk and do nothing else because everything will be closed.
Remember, make sure anyone doesn't join you on that walk or you will be fined.
All right.
And not to stop or else I'll suddenly be surrounded by 12 people.
Indeed. You live alone, right? So you don't even have an immediate household, right? Right. That's fine. I actually have to go to the university tomorrow to do some work. I mean, it's not a social gathering. I'm not going to be seeing anyone. But it's going to be fun to see people totally not breaking the rules in the library and stuff. So see how that goes.
Keep a tally of how many people you see without masks and just get very sad.
I'm, you know, past few months have really, even though like there's been so many protests about cops, like just seeing people without masks on buses and stuff makes me want to become a real narc, you know, and just narc them out and like be a total cop about it. But like, I just don't have the energy to, but I really want to.
Just pretend to get a phone call and be talking to it and be like, yeah, Steve, there's so many people on this bus not wearing masks, like irresponsible jerks. And I'm almost at the potluck. Goodbye.
I mean, that would be very hilarious considering if I was going to a potluck, I would be breaking multiple rules also. But you know, that'd be pretty nice. This is completely unrelated. Actually, that sort of happened to me. I was taking a bus. Where was I taking it? I was taking it to get a flu shot on last Friday. And I was taking the bus. And then there was a dude opposite me without a mask. I didn't want to engage. Because he looked like those sort of civil liberties, like libertarian sort of dudes. I could just tell from his... I mean, he didn't really have anything on him. But, you know, sometimes you can just tell. So I was listening to music and I was like, okay, I just compartmentalize this. I'm not going to deal with it. And I think someone actually told him to wear a mask or something. I don't actually remember because I was listening to music. But then I could hear like rumblings of like people talking. And I was like, okay, sure. This is something I'm going to have to deal with. He gets off. So I was taking the bus. I was taking the 99. So I think he gets off at Broadway City Hall. And then he like rushes the bus and like taps on the, like pretty aggressively taps on the window of the person who called him out. And like, I don't know exactly what he said. He's probably swearing. And that was not fun. Not fun at all. And everyone on the bus freaked out. So irresponsible doesn't really come close to the sorts of people who are not wearing masks right now. They're not well adjusted. Let's just put it that way.
I feel like it's just hearing things like that, I just kind of want to stop people and be like, is this really about the mask? You know, like, is it really about this? Like, I don't know.
To be fair, I mean, when I'm on the bus or when I'm out and about, well, like, especially on the bus, I don't see too many people not wearing them. Like, I think there's most people, we're all on the same page on this. So there's just a very loud minority that are just... loud and not the wisest, but I think most people are on the same page. That's me trying to be an optimist here.
Yeah, so I take the 99 a lot, and you know, the most traveled bus in North America. So I see maybe one person every two trips. Like, not, it's not like a lot of people. It's usually just one person. And sometimes it isn't even that. Like, sometimes someone isn't wearing a mask. They get on the bus and they wear a mask. And I'm like, that completely defeats the purpose. Like, there's no point in doing that. But, I mean, at least they're wearing a mask, I guess. But, like, you know, I'm not going to get into mask etiquette on this show. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On The Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming.